Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, our guest is Jeff Fromm. He's president of FutureCast. Millennials are a large generation. They are now the biggest group in the workforce. How do we handle them? What do we do? How do we market them? How to retain them? How do we hire them? Great questions for Jeff. Let's ask him now. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're going to be talking with a brand new guest. His name is Jeff Fromm. He's from FutureCast, and we're going to be talking about everybody's favorite topic, the millennials. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, our favorite group. I almost feel like, Debbie, we need to have some music. Millennials in the background. Anyways, it is the favorite topic. It is the group that is now 50% of the workforce or more. And we'll get into specifics here with Jeff. But, hey, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David.
So tell us about this big old massive honking group, the millennials.
Well, let's just start by debunking myths about the millennials. They are not all broke, unemployed, living in their parents' basements among a collection of participation trophies they've never earned. And, oh, by the way, they're not all narcissists either. They are actually the most savvy generation of consumers and employees we've ever seen, capable of processing more information from more sources than any generation ever before them. Unfortunately, though, they will not work for you forever. If you do a great job, they're probably only going to be there a few years.
Well, that is one of the challenges, isn't it? That in this day and age, with the unemployment and the rates that they are today, employers are finding it a challenge to keep and maintain and attract millennials. So let's start on that side of it, please, if we could. Let's talk about millennials in the sense of what they're really looking for, what keeps them excited, and why they want to go work for an organization.
Well, a starting point and often misstated fact is they do want a great salary and great benefits, but that alone is not enough because there are plenty of companies that are going to offer them similar salaries and similar benefits. So one, if your corporate values align to their personal values, that's important. They want work-life balance. And third, and equally importantly, they want a lot of coaching, which is different than what people expect. A lot of people think they don't want a boss. And they don't want a traditional boss. They want a boss that's a coach.
When you say a coach, I mean, look, these people have had coaches their whole lives, right? As you point out, they've had coaches from their parents. They've had coaches from their, sports where they, as you put it, get a trophy for everything. How does a...
David, I would argue they don't get a trophy for everything. That's just popular media having fun with the millennials.
All right, so they don't get a trophy for everything, or the perception is they do. Let's put it that, because perception is, in some case, reality. Tell us a little bit about how an organization goes about really thinking about coaching from a serious standpoint.
Well, there are a whole bunch of different pieces and parts. There's training and opportunities for learning, not just about my job or the job that I might get next, but about life skills. Maybe I'm not in a finance role, but they're going to give me finance skills or leadership skills or emotional intelligence skills. Certainly, there are a variety of other factors. Many companies have gone from annual reviews to quarterly check-ins. They do want feedback. The opportunity to customize and personalize their work experience. You know, obviously, if you work in a factory and the plant starts at 7 a.m., you got to be there at 7 a.m., but there are an awful lot of knowledge workers who could work at home on Friday and want to work at home on Friday, and we should be measuring output, not time spent sitting at a desk.
So one of the things you talk about in the workplace that they need that they don't need trophies, but they want reinforcement. And that's kind of a piece of this coaching puzzle you're talking about, correct? That's consistent reinforcement that they need. It kind of flies in the stereotypical, you know, one-time-a-year review model that most companies have.
Yeah, David, I think they want more feedback because they're used to processing more information from growing up with a mobile phone that allows them to process a lot of information. Of course, we all know it's not really a phone because there's no millennial on the planet that's going to call you back. But they are used to doing that, and so you have to obviously do it in a way that makes sense. People don't want to hear you're terrible and you should do X. They want to hear here's alternative ideas. You have to lay candy out that they can easily find as opposed to, you know, trying to provide feedback that might be destructive. And I think if it's done properly, they will grab the opportunity for improvement in many cases. And I think there are an awful lot of millennials who are worried about improving in their career. But the career doesn't mean I'm going to be with your company forever. It might be several years, but the reality is if you're doing it right, when they leave, they say great things about you as a boss and the company, and it becomes much easier to fill that position than it would be if they left and said, this company is terrible, because remember, millennials are going online to check out your company and read what people say about the company.
In Forbes magazine, you did an article called The Millennials in the Workplace. They don't need trophies, but they want reinforcement. One of the topics that you brought up in that is they don't want to waste time on the little things. What do you mean by that?
I think millennials are trying to make a difference at their companies, and then they're also trying to make a difference in terms of their personal career path, and then hopefully that all aligns to their values and making the world a better place. So if your company has lots of red tape and creates ways to make it harder to achieve their personal and corporate goals, I think your company needs to look at destroying those practices. And there are an awful lot of companies say, well, we want X, but then they put in systems and processes designed to make it harder for employees to do what they want. They don't empower the employee to solve the problem without checking first. They create barriers that frustrate those millennial employees who are trying to do the right thing. And they're not going to always do it right, but an awful lot of companies are not thinking about the impact of those barriers and stop signs.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting area because obviously as we continue to look at how millennials are going to shift, and as you know, they're about 50% of the workplace now, this is the future of the generation. And to your point, they talk about they want, as you said, work-life balance, but they want democracy as well. What do they mean by that? Hey, this is a business. The boss gets what he wants, right?
Well, David, I'm going to have to say wrong. I think millennials want the survival of the fittest, and most organizations are still set up in a hierarchical model where whoever's the most senior person or been there the longest has, quote, tenure or authority. And millennials, if that person's the most qualified, will respect it. But if that person's the least qualified, they won't. And this frustrates many older employees. Like, I've paid my dues. Okay, that's great. You paid your dues. Are you still the best at what you do? Because if you're not, let's make room for the people who are. And I think we'll see, and we already are seeing in many European companies, the emergence of holacracy, where it's about the democratization of giving people the chance who are best qualified. And sometimes that's the employee who's been there the longest, but sometimes it's not. So many systems are in favor of whoever's got the most tenure, not whoever's best at what they do.
As you talk about, there are a lot of myths with millennials. One is that millennials are just flat out lazy. They're the laziest generation ever. That's not true, is it?
I haven't seen any data that supports it. So, you know, maybe Donald Trump could make it true, but, you know, he doesn't need data. Otherwise, I think I'd need some data to understand it. I have anecdotal data from the small number of millennial employees that work for me, and it's the opposite. It's, hey, if there's a crucial project that needs to be done, they're probably the people who are burning the midnight oil when it needs to get done. So I think they want the balance, though. If they burn the midnight oil today, that doesn't mean that they want to burn the midnight oil again and again just to do it. They want to do it when it's needed, not just to prove that I put in the most hours. And so my anecdotal observation is far different than that characterization. But if there's data that's been done, and a study that actually looks at the topic, I'd certainly take a look at it. I just haven't seen it, and I've seen quite a bit of data.
So, you know, one of the things that you talk about in terms of key points for a millennial is a collaborative workplace culture. We talked a little bit about it with democracy. But can you give into some specifics? Can you give some examples of you know, what that really means?
Sure. I think that they want the opportunity to contribute, and in many cases, they don't, quote, want to expect to have to pay their dues first. So if the contribution is real, let them contribute. I have colleagues who are 23 and 4 years old who've spoken at events, like you saw me speak at Southern Maine, because I was conflicted out. In the old days, you would have never let someone do that. But they were qualified, they knew the topic, and they hit it out of the park. I think they want the opportunity to make a difference and to take on more responsibility than most companies will let them take on. They've gone through college, they've studied, they've worked, and they want to write the deck. They want to make the presentation. They want to do the work. And they don't want to just help and then not be invited to the meeting, not be invited to the discussion. So as you think about it, are you creating an environment that invites them to take on more responsibility and then have a seat at the table when it's time to talk about it? Because if you're doing that, you're going to probably win. The flip side is if they're only the people doing the background scut work, never invited to the party, never given the opportunity to do more complex kind of work, then boredom can set in. And if boredom sets in, we know they can find another job, and they will. If they're learning, then they're probably less likely to try to find another job.
And that's probably what you're really talking about is a learning culture, right? Someone who has an organ.
Absolutely, David. Absolutely. And the learning culture is such a huge piece. If they're learning, and that could be on the job, that could be training that's offered by the company, and the training can be adjacent training. I have a daughter who works at Pinterest. She doesn't know how to code. It's not part of her job responsibility, but the company's willing to pay for her to have a class, which will allow her to do a better job working with people who do. So, you know, is your company willing to give people the opportunity to do that? Do you have online training? Do you have access to tools and resources? If they're learning, then they're probably going to get pretty charged up about their work.
When you're also talking about that learning aspect of it, they also have to also have a career ladder idea of where they're going, don't they? Is it important for an organization to really start looking at, you know, what is that next career path? And in some organizations, that could be kind of hard.
Yeah, I think that's a crucial point, David. They do want to have some sense of what is the next opportunity and what those things look like, and they don't have the same intent to wait. So if the path is 8 years to vice president at Company X, you know, it may be more important to find stepping stone opportunities in between promotions that didn't exist before to create new levels so they can feel like they're progressing on that path. And that is different, and that is an expectation that they have that is different. But I don't think we're going to change that expectation. Rather, what we can do is say, well, we had 3 titles in that 8-year sequence before, let's have 5, or whatever the right number is, so they can see they're making progress toward their eventual goal.
Yeah, and it's not that they necessarily have to achieve it within, you know, 3 months or 6 months, but as long as they can see that path is a year down the road and they can get training and development to get to that point, I think you have a really good chance of retaining them. Would you agree?
I would agree with that. I think it's an important point, and I think the other thing that I'm going to come back to that's an important point is that quarterly check-in allows the coach, supervisor, and the employee partner to make sure we understand, hey, we are still on that path. We are, you know, you're still on track for the opportunities. And by doing it quarterly instead of annually, there's more opportunity to discuss areas that might need to improve and more opportunities to highlight things that they're doing correctly. And if quarterly isn't the right answer, maybe you do it more often, maybe you do it less often. But once a year, that's an old school model, and that is not a feedback loop that would be consistent with their expectations.
When you're talking about coaching, you're also really talking about things like mentoring and other systemic systems that really put people in touch with others in a more, you know, continuous basis, correct?
Yes, I am. I'm talking about creating a relationship that is a little more personal with the people that you work with, in the sense that you know them, which builds trust, and that you're providing actionable information that allows them to make progress toward their goals. And that's pretty important. I think that's what they're looking for in that relationship.
And, that's what they're expecting, really, almost more than even looking for today.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And I think it requires a more emotionally intelligent supervisor who will take a little extra time and think about how to identify areas that they can improve and highlight things that they're achieving so that they get more clarity around that path and around how they can make a bigger contribution. Because they want to make a bigger contribution, and they want to get a raise, and they want to get a bonus, and they're, you know, a lot of myths that they don't care, and that's just not true. I haven't met that many employees that don't care if they get a raise and don't care if they get a bonus and don't care if they're making pay. And if that employee worked for me, I honestly wouldn't want them to work for me. I want people who want to make progress, right?
Well, and that wouldn't matter of the generation in reality. That's just a systemic problem in terms of you got the wrong person in the right in the wrong seat at that point.
Absolutely. And I think that maybe the difference is the patience meter is a little amped up for this generation in terms of what the expectation is. And that's not necessarily a bad thing if you're getting the contribution.
We're talking with Jeff Fromm. He is from FutureCast. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Join your colleagues on Wednesday, November 9 at the Augusta Civic Center to learn, network, and get inspired at the 7th Annual Maine Biz Momentum Convention. Momentum is an annual convention hosted by Maine Biz aimed at fostering growth and innovation in Maine. It's a full day of learning and networking with industry leaders, peers, and customers. You'll spend the day with some of Maine's most successful CEOs, business owners, and leaders who will share insights and transformational strategies they use to launch their companies to new heights. Start your day with the Maine at Work Initiative Executive Breakfast. Attend Maine Biz U in three sessions with topics focused on the new Maine workplace, worker, and economy. And chart the course for your business by catching the keynote address delivered by IMSCIP. Register for your Maine Biz Momentum Convention Pass today by visiting MomentumConvention.com. That's MomentumConvention.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, I'm your host, David Chulo, and we're talking with our good friend, Jeff Fromm, president of FutureCast, and we're talking about everybody's favorite topic. That's right, everybody's favorite topic, the good old millennials. You know, Jeff, I say that obviously with a little tongue-in-cheek, but the reality is that millennials are now the biggest workforce group, and it is something that we all need to pay attention with. You know, my son said to me, you'll appreciate this, he works with me, and he said very simply, and quote, unquote, you know, it's very simple if you don't really like if you don't really like what you like, you don't. I said, if you don't like being here, then you don't have to work here. He goes, no, that's fine. I'm just going to wait for you to retire, and then I'll do it my way anyway.
I'm sure you appreciated that feedback.
You know, it's just one of those things. You know, it's a good thing, because I then fired him and rehired him in the same second. But, you know, you can do that when it's family, right? It's kind of how the game's played. Do you see, and I say that tongue-in-cheek, but do you see that millennials really look sometimes at their boss, they look something at their group, and they say to themselves, dear God, these people, if they just get out of my way, I could do so much more.
I mean, I think I felt that way when I was younger, and I don't think it's changed a whole lot. If the person who's younger feels that he or she is more capable on a particular topic than their boss, I'm sure they're thinking, could you just move out of my way so I could get my job done?
Well, I think you're right, and I think in some cases, part of what we know is that whether it's millennials, whether it's baby boomers, whether it's Xers, they all have their own issues, and they all have their own, you know, people are still people at the end of the day, correct?
Yeah, they are.
So one of the topics and areas that I would like to talk to you about is about branding. Millennials really look at brand as a very important part of who they are, the brand of a company, who they are, and sometimes brands in general. What's your take on this?
I think that branding is probably more important today than ever before for several reasons. First, in almost every category, there are proliferations of choices. Direct and indirect alternatives and competitors exist. So if you don't have a brand, then you're basically going to be left competing on price. And most companies don't like to try to be the low-price provider of products and services. Now, there are certainly exceptions. But even if you only compete on price, it's better if people recognize and appreciate your brand. The other issues related to brand and why that's so important is it gives everyone such a clear view of your strategy, not just consumers, but also what I'll call your brand fans and your employee stakeholders. The brand fans are the small group of people, sometimes 1% or 2% of your customers, who advocate for your brand at their time and expense to other consumers. And this is crucial in today's world. The other thing is, if you have that clear brand, then your employees understand where to go with product and service innovation, how to manage customer requests, etc. I mean, it just helps everyone move more in an aligned way and more rapidly toward your goal.
When you're looking and talking to organizations about how to better align that, what are some of the key steps they can take to align not only the brand, but to align this group of individuals behind it?
There are a variety of different ways to go about it. One thing you can do is you could ask everyone in your company to come to a company meeting, pull out a sheet of paper if you want, and write down in as short a way as possible what your brand stands for, and then go through it and see, is everyone aligned, right? Like, if we had that meeting at Nike, would everyone say, we're empowering the athlete and everyone? And if the answer is yes, then you probably have a very clear and very strong brand. If, on the other hand, you had 50 people in your company and you got 50 different pieces of paper back with 50 different answers, I'd say you got a problem. And so... I think that's just a simple gut check, right? The obvious, more complex route that a larger company would likely pursue is to also look at consumer attitudes, consumer beliefs. A strong brand means that a consumer will prefer your brand even if there's an alternative that might be a little bit less expensive or a little bit more easily reached. I'll drive the extra block for gas from my preferred gas station. I'll drive the extra block to shop at the grocery store that I like, etc.
When you're talking about, obviously here, corporate brands or company brands, how about an individual's brand? How about the boss or how about even the employee? They have a brand. I mean, today with Glassdoor and others out there, your brand is not only about your company, but it's also about the people that work for you.
No doubt that there are both kinds of brands, and people often don't think enough about their personal brand. In today's age, there are an awful lot of people who use social media
if for no other reason than to just sort of scan through and see what's going on. So you need to be able to, at some level, curate your brand and think about that both in the office and online, both. And in the office, you know, are you someone who's helpful? Are you someone who's positive? Are you someone who's making a contribution? Are you someone that if they were rehiring today for your position, that they would rehire you over the other candidates that might be available? If we were starting with no one in that job, would you still be the person they would bring in? Or would they say, I've been exposed to him or her. I'll probably try someone else.
You know, part of this branding, part of this organization being a place that they want to work, talks a lot about their giving back to making the world a better place. You know, this really caring in not only the environment, but the company programs of what's going on. Talk to us a little bit about some of the research you've done in this and some of the areas that you talk about providing rewarding work.
There's no doubt that there's an awful lot of interest in doing more than what's best for me. Obviously, a starting point for the vast majority of people is what's in my best interest. Where I work at Barclay, which is the parent company to FutureCast, we regularly, throughout the year, are given time off at the company's expense, and we'll often do projects as a group, so it builds teamwork, where we'll work in a food pantry, or we'll volunteer to do some project, build a playground. So you feel good because we don't work with our hands, right? I'm a knowledge worker. You feel good giving someone who doesn't have a playground, or someone who doesn't have food, food. And to be able to do that where the company is spending the money to shuttle you to the location, to buy everyone lunch, to pay for the materials, that's where you say, okay, my company is doing something that I like. And it's not coming out of my Saturday. It's we took off Thursday and did that, and I got paid to work Thursday, but instead of working in the office, I worked to build a playground. So I think those are the kinds of things people are looking for and expecting.
So when you say they're expecting it, how big is it on the scale of priorities? And we're obviously talking about millennials, but how big is it on that scale of priorities for millennials when they're looking at a place to work?
It's a factor. If all things are equal, it's an important factor. If Company A is offering me 50% more compensation than Company B, then it might not matter, right? But oftentimes the difference in compensation can be very small, and the difference in benefits can be very small. So I think it's a very important factor because most companies aren't going to overpay for somebody's work. So they say, okay, well, we're offering a competitive wage, we're offering a competitive benefits package, we're offering a competitive environment where people... So then it becomes a huge factor because now it's, do your values as a company, you know, empower me, make me feel better about where I am? If people feel better about where they work, that's a competitive advantage. And so now all of a sudden you're tipping the scale. But if you're capable of giving them something that's an advantage in benefits or compensation that's materially better than your competitors, and you can sustain that, then it's important, but it's going to be diminished.
You know, one of the other topics that I wanted to mention and talk with you is really about employee engagement. And you make the point that millennials are different, but in fact, they're probably the same. What do you mean by that?
David, I think when it comes to employee engagement, millennials will work really, really hard, contrary to whatever you've heard or read, when they feel like the company and their supervisor care about what they're doing, and what they're doing is making an impact and a difference. If someone who's young, who's been out of school a year or two or three, feels like they're making an impact and the work they're doing is being noticed, then they feel really great about what they're doing. If, on the other hand, they feel like, I'm just a cog in a machine, I'm just a number here, then how engaged are they going to be? So a lot of this gets down to human emotion and how I feel about the people I work with, the team I'm on, my boss. And I'm working because I want to help contribute to that team. I want to feel, and so if I feel like my work matters, then I give extra, and I work harder. I don't think people try to do a bad job. But if they feel like nobody cares, then what happens is sometimes that's what it is, a bad job.
Well, we talk about, right, providing rewarding work, providing learning opportunities. We had that discussion in the first segment. There's also this part of aligning jobs to individual strengths. And I think, you know, sometimes that can be hard in some organizations, but it can be really rewarding for the individual person if they actually are going to be truly engaged. They have to be really aligned with what they're doing, don't they?
Yeah, David, that's a great point. I think it's sometimes harder when you have a young person who may not have figured out exactly where their strengths are yet, or might feel like strong in a lot of areas when in fact they're strong in a couple areas and need to improve in some. But, you know, if you're on a team, the goal is to make sure everyone's doing what they do best. And I think in sports we see that all the time, right? We see that we put the best second baseman at second base and the best catcher at catcher. In business we don't always do that. We try to be fair. And so I think if everyone understands that both positions are equally important, try to put the best person at each position and work together in a collaborative environment and celebrate victories, celebrate success. And the celebrating success and victories as a team then allows everyone to understand my individual role is important, whether I'm the proofreader or the creator, right? And some people would say, well, the proofreader, that's not the important job, it's the creator. It's like, well, no, if the team is doing error-free work and we're celebrating those victories, then so it becomes cultural, and it becomes important for leaders to understand that it's not just about did you meet whatever goal you had, but do people feel like they have contributed? And if they feel charged up about it, the odds are much higher that they're going to continue not only to stay at the company but perform at a high level.
One of the trends we see a lot, and it's been talked about not only on the show but other places, is about boomeranging, which, as you know, is somebody comes to an organization, they stay 3-4 years, and then they go somewhere else, they gain more experience, and they come back. This seems to be ripe for millennials in terms of them being, you know, looking at how we can get more experience somewhere else, and then, hey, I really liked it there, so I'd like to go back. And sometimes the older generations are like, no, you left. And I think that that's a miss in some areas. Would you agree?
Boy, I think that's crucially important. At our company, we have about 400 employees. Our CEO boomeranged. I boomeranged. I'm a division president. And quite a few of our other senior people boomeranged. Likewise, there's nothing more wonderful when a 27-year-old comes back and says, I can't believe I left. That the grass wasn't greener. Because that tells everyone else, hey, you know what? Maybe the grass isn't greener. You think it's not perfect, and you like it, but there are gaps between what you would say is perfect and what's going on. When someone comes back, that sends a pretty clear message that they opted back in. And I know we have a ton of boomerangs in our company, both in very senior roles and in junior roles and everywhere in between, because oftentimes people realize a year later, I made a mistake. It wasn't a great idea. And I'm a boomerang that's proud of it, right? I'm like, I left, and it wasn't better.
No, and that's a big point, I think, to really being open to understanding that, you know, their trends have shifted, and people have to be willing and open to look and be mindful of that change in terms of the dynamics.
I will add, David, though, obviously, I had to make a great contribution the first time I was there, or nobody would want me as a boomerang. So if someone's leaving on great terms, then they're a logical boomerang candidate. If someone's leaving on something less than great terms, then there's probably not a high probability that they're going to boomerang.
Well, I think from that standpoint, it goes back to the old saying, don't burn your bridge, right? Just if you're given a 2-week notice, you should probably work as hard as you worked your first 2 weeks of work during the last 2 weeks so that you can leave on that high and somebody will really want you back.
Exactly. And the reality is, even if you don't boomerang, you could end up running into some of the same people you worked with in a new company because you might stay in the same industry.
No, there's no question. And this is the old saying, and it goes back a million years, and it doesn't really matter what generation. You know, do the right thing, right? Be the right person, and you will always have success because it is a people world.
Yeah.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB 100.5 FM. We're talking with Jeff Fromm, president from FutureCast, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Senator Amy Volk. As I walk through the neighborhoods of my district meeting my constituents this election season, one message is clear at every door. People are fed up with the political discourse in Maine and throughout the country. I couldn't agree more. I, too, am sick of the partisan rancor and name-calling. I spent two terms in the Maine House and one term in the Senate working with lawmakers from both parties to accomplish real change for the people of Gorham, Scarborough, and Buxton. In fact, the nonpartisan Sunlight Foundation found me to be one of the most bipartisan legislators in Maine. This year, I was awarded a Certificate of Achievement from the American Conservative Union, indicating that while working in a bipartisan fashion, I was able to remain true to my conservative principles. It has been a privilege serving the people of Gorham, Scarborough, and Buxton, and I ask for your vote so I can continue the great work we accomplished this last session. I will return to Augusta and provide the experienced, principled, bipartisan leadership you've come to expect. This is Amy Volk. I ask for your vote on November 8th.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're talking with our good friend Jeff Fromm. He is the president of FutureCast. Jeff, you know, I got to tell you, I think I want to ask one general question. What is FutureCast? Let's let the audience know what you do.
Sure. Thanks, David. FutureCast is a consumer trends consultancy, and it's a subsidiary of independent ad agency Barclay. So we provide insights that brands use to reimagine their best possible future. We facilitate meetings. We do consumer research work. We're a strategy group.
No, that's great. And so that fits right into where I'm going to go with this next category, because obviously we're talking about millennials. Talk to us about that consumer group, that millennial consumer group. What are they looking for companies to really provide to them?
So first, millennials are not a homogenous cohort. 10,000 women today are going to have a child. Those millennials who are having children look pretty different than a millennial who's in college. There are almost 10 million millennials who make over $100,000 a year. Many of those are in urban markets. More of them are women than men. So the consumer economy is evolving rapidly. I think at a high level, companies want to buy great quality products at a fair price from ethical companies. And they are looking for brands to be more useful. But useful depends on my life stage and need states. So useful could look very different for one consumer than another, and it could look very different from one brand to another. But for those women who are having children, they really want a clean household. So if I was in the cleaning business, whether that's Clorox or whether that's someone who manufactures equipment or whether that's someone who provides a service, that's very different than a brand that maybe is a grocery store who, how can you save me time because I'm time pressed. But both are useful. Usefulness is the new cool.
No, and that certainly is. And so as companies try to think about, what they need to do to go out and market to these organizations and to these groups, I know there are a lot of new rules and regulations out there. Talk a little bit about that, because social media has just changed so dramatically.
So the way I would think about it, before I dove into social media, I would think about my content strategy. Content is currency. And if you can inspire consumers to consume, curate, and create content about your brand and the topics adjacent to your brand, then there's a pretty good chance you're going to win.
And so I would really give some thought to what's my brand's responsibility to creating content. We have a white paper on this topic. It's a two cup of coffee kind of an article at millennialmarketing.com on the research tab, and it is free. Regarding social media, I also think you have to be channel appropriate. And so what I would put in LinkedIn might be very different than what I would put in Facebook or Instagram. So as I think about social media channels are proliferating, and the industry is not mature, but maturing. And as a brand, you need to make sure you're using the right content, the right channel. But I'd always start with content strategy at the forefront, at the beginning, and then start to think about the delivery of that through social channels.
So from a content perspective, are there certain key traits or key areas that would you would say to yourself, these are must-have when you're trying to target that market?
Content is a big, huge bucket. I think it would be very different for someone who's a B2B firm, maybe on a law firm, an accounting firm, versus a consumer brand. At the core, content could inspire me. Content could inform me. Content could make me laugh. Content could make me cry. Content could do any number of things. So I would develop a portfolio approach to my content, just like I might have a portfolio of products and services that I offer, knowing that different consumers have different needs. Some people want short-form content. Some people want to dive in. They want long-form content. Some people are going to watch a video. So at the end of the day, the content gets a report card. I have a blog. I mentioned it's Millennial Marketing. I have 17,000 weekly readers, which is up quite a bit. So I'm getting a good report card. If it was down, I'd be getting a bad report card. So I look at how much, not just how many people come to use the content, but also how much time they're spending with content. So I'm a big fan that content is a way to compete, particularly for brands that say, well, we don't have a big budget. Okay, well, no one needs a big budget to win on content. What you need is a brain to think about what would cause someone to be highly engaged in what you do, whether that's, you know, helping someone create an estate plan or whether that's selling baby food. Content matters.
When you're talking about obviously providing content, the challenge sometimes with that is that it can get wordy, it can get a little bit too much. What's too much?
I think it's always important to have someone try to help you edit, and it depends on the subject. I would, again, have a portfolio approach. If I'm selling baby food, I'd have some short, pithy information, written, video, and otherwise. The flip side is I'd have some long form on hot topics. If it's a hot topic that matters to me, I'll spend a fair amount of time with it. If I have an allergy to a certain food, I'll read up on it. Likewise, if I was trying to create a piece of B2B content, it depends on the importance of the content. And I would often try to create a summary so someone who wants the short version can get the short version. Someone who wants the deep dive can get the deep dive. Because we know that there are going to be people who want both forms. And you'll see that when you go to the blog, actually. You'll see that article I referenced. On brand, there's one that's really long on that research tab. There are other very short-form things that are designed to be consumed very rapidly. And I think it's important that you understand what your audience wants. And the subject will vary, right? Because if it's a subject with important long-term impact, I'm going to probably spend more time with it than if it's something like a candy bar. I probably am not going to spend a ton of time on a candy bar, so I will want short-form content, and that would be most relevant to me in that scenario. Now, baby food, even though it might be inexpensive, if my baby has an allergy, I might spend a lot of time on that content.
No, it's absolutely. It's individually driven, and that makes sometimes the challenge of marketing, isn't it? Because you're trying to give a general information piece to a specific group sometimes.
Right, and so, you know, the way I would think about it is to think about the different personas or subsets of consumers that you serve and then to create content that's wildly interesting to them. And if you do that, they will obviously reward you by not only probably consuming the content, but if it's super helpful, they'll share it. They'll pass it along. And that's pretty important in today's age where we know consumers are more likely to listen to another consumer often than they are to a company. So if a consumer says, this is really informative, I'm pretty likely to take a look at that. My friend says, hey, Jeff, I know you have an allergy to X. Why don't you take a look at X? I'm going to, you know, an article on this. I'm going to look at that article.
No, it really is. And this sharing culture of being able to send out that information has become really the new way of marketing, correct?
I think it's a piece of it, yes, absolutely correct. I don't think it's the entire thing, but I think it's a crucial piece. And it's a way to differentiate your brand. If you had two products that were both wonderful products, fairly priced, and one had content that inspired or informed me that was better than someone else's, even if both products were high quality, the company with the better content would win.
Absolutely. No, there's no question about that. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts, stoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we've been talking with a great guest, Jeff Fromm, president of FutureCast. We've been talking about millennials, that amazing new group that is really, actually it's not that new, it's been around for a while, but an amazing group that is now the largest workforce group in the world. You know, Jeff, one of the things that you've talked about here, as we have about 5 minutes left in the show today, is you've talked about, obviously, branding, you've talked about employee engagement, we've talked about a lot of topics, but I'd like to end with what we like to say the world is the ROI, the kicker, the ROI. So for companies that really want to make a profit, which is what we're all about, making a profit with these new consumers, what are some of the key tips that and trends that are out there that they can really go after to make this work?
I think making a profit is a byproduct of creating a service or a product that's of high value to a like-minded group of individuals, and that's the reward. And so as I think about it, most companies tend to look at their brand awareness or their overall satisfaction and try to understand, you know, is our brand awareness increasing? Is our overall satisfaction increasing? And I think that's important, but I don't think it's enough. I think if you have high brand awareness and if you have high overall satisfaction, which many companies do, they've been in business for a while, people know who they are, they have to start thinking about the three keys that today's modern consumer demands. And those three keys are uniqueness, meaningfulness, and innovation. So I'm going to spend a little time talking about each of them. If you want to drive your profits, which again is a byproduct of providing great service or a great product, you need some level of uniqueness. And the most unique brands have more pricing authority. And pricing authority is crucially important in driving a profit, and it's often overlooked. So I think if I was suggesting someone spend some more time thinking about the notion of uniqueness and pricing authority, think about the products that you're willing to pay a small premium for and think about why they're unique and matter to you. And you could look at the work done by Young Min Moon at Harvard Business School if you're interested in some of the underlying research. We've also got a second factor, which is meaningfulness or purpose. And we've heard a lot about the topic of meaningfulness and purpose recently in the business space. And the reason is that many companies offer similar products at similar prices or similar services at similar prices. And so there's little gap between company A, company B, and company C. And what can be very meaningful in terms of the ability to differentiate is the notion that my values as a company align to your values. So if I'm Warby Parker and I offer buy one, give one, or if I'm Dove and I create a campaign around real beauty, or I'm AT&T and I start a don't text and drive movement, now, even though the price of my product might be the same as the price of my competitors, I'm giving people a reason to pick me on values. And so meaningfulness really drives sales volume potential. And we see in the research that consumers prefer brands when all other factors are similar, prefer brands whose values aligned to theirs. And so I would look at this whole movement around conscious capitalism as a way to create meaningful, sustainable differentiation. The other benefit of this is employees also prefer working for companies whose values align to theirs. And then the third piece is innovation. We live in a world where consumers are absolutely looking for life hacks,
looking to save time, looking to have a more simplified worldview. And so if you can innovate in favor of making my life better, I love your brand. And innovation is an ongoing need state for many consumers. They're willing to pay for companies that are simplifying. So as I think about driving profits, I'm not saying awareness and overall satisfaction are unimportant. I'm saying it's insufficient to only look at those factors. You must look at how you're going to be more unique, more meaningful, and more innovative. And the rules are always changing. What was unique a couple years ago might be less unique today. And so you're going to have to think about, okay, is what I think is unique, is it still unique? Or are other companies doing it? And the reality is it's not just your direct competitors. Consumers are influenced by who's setting a standard. So in terms of convenience, the standard is being set by Amazon and Amazon Prime. And it doesn't matter if you don't compete with Amazon. Consumers are influenced by that experience. So that's a lot to think about for people, but I think it's a good way for someone to dive in quickly and think about how I can drive consumer preference and consumer value. And if I improve preference and value, I will have the intended outcome of helping my company increase its profits.
So, Jeff, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, obviously after the show, they can go to hrpowerhour.com. They can obviously see your show here after the show, and they'll have an email to connect with you directly. But what is your email directly?
I am JFROMM, JFROM, at thefuturecast.com. And I'm also pretty easily found in LinkedIn if you type in Jeff Fromm and add the word millennials, and anyone will quickly find me immediately. And I'd be happy to connect anyone who wants to connect via LinkedIn or take any questions or comments or consulting projects for that matter if someone wants to drop me a quick note.
No, that's perfect. And as I said, certainly after this show, all that information will be on hrpowerhour.com. We appreciate you being on the show today, Jeff. Great information about millennials, and thank you for being our guest.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
This is Tawny Alvarez with VeralDana. Are your oral warnings flowing in one ear and out the other? Have you spoken to problem employees about the same issues over and over again, but the message just doesn't seem to be getting through? While oral warnings are given to the employee orally, a written record of the conversation should be maintained to refer back to the discussion should the individual's behavior fail to improve. By memorializing the conversation, you will have a firsthand account of the situation shortly after the conversation occurred, and it will be a great deal of assistance should you ever find yourself litigating the case in the future. Contact a member of VeralDana's Labor Employment Practice Group if you'd like to discuss more.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, strategic futurist and speaker, as well as CEO of Play Big Inc. and Cultural Acupuncture, Nancy Giordano will be talking about the big shift, what leaders must know about the new economy. We're going to be talking about all sorts of amazing futuristic things. I'm not kidding, but I'm going to keep you guessing so that you listen next week on the HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.